revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a friend of the show who's returning to speak with us. It's Dr. Sutter. And last time we talked, it's always timely and about current events, which I don't think people think much about. And I know there's been a lot of conversation about NGOs and what they do. If they provide social services for the government, exactly what are their purpose? And I think we're getting a lot of, you know, I think to me, horrific stories about people taking advantage of the taxpayer. And I'm sure we're not alone in the U.S. I'm sure it probably goes on in other countries. But I wanted to speak with Dr. Sutter about what an NGO is and how this is affecting the average citizen. So Dr. Sutter, as everybody knows, is the Charles G. Koch Professor of Economics with the Manuel H. Johnson Center for Political Economy at Troy University. He's a wealth of knowledge about the economy and a real gift in being able to explain it in terms that people can follow. So Dr. Sutter, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. George, for having me on. It's always a pleasure to join you and talk about current events and economic policy.
Well, I'm intrigued by your article that's entitled "When Government Outsources Compassion, Fraud Moves In." And, you know, we have a lot of states now that are, it seems like it's mushrooming, or maybe it's always been the case, but now it's being really highlighted. Minnesota, Maine, California. Let's start off with, what's a non-governmental organization exactly?
Well, it's something that's not, you know, I guess it would be the modern version of a traditional charity. And so it's organized, it's tax exempt, it can receive tax, you know, donations that are tax exempt, or you can get a tax deduction for giving money to it. And so in one sense, they are like charities. But the new thing that's really emerged over probably the last 20 years or so is a lot of NGOs working in the really sort of in the public assistance space within coordination with government. So now a lot of social services go through these NGOs through contracts by a state or city government or the federal government with an NGO. They also receive donations, and again, the older versions of them would rely primarily on donations. Things like the Salvation Army, or one that I've come across and worked with in my research is Samaritan's Purse. So you have a lot of these traditional charities, which would now be organized in this fashion. But then you also have this sort of new thing, this group that really gets funded by the government to provide a lot of social services in what you could think of perhaps as a privatized fashion.
So it's another one of these public-private partnerships, it sounds like.
Yeah, it sure is. Especially these ones that work in the, work closely with government or through the government contracts. Yes, definitely. That's a good way of describing it.
Well, it's a loaded question, but what do they have to gain if they're really just for philanthropy? Is there money to be made doing this?
For the NGO?
Yeah.
Well, yes. They are technically nonprofits, so they're not supposed to make a profit. But of course, economists, when we look at nonprofit organizations, often think like, well, you know, they might be getting some benefits in some form other than a profit that you declare and take home. So certainly one of the things in terms of benefits for the NGO would be many people who work for them, especially in management or executive level positions, get paid pretty good money. You know, so there are some really well-paying jobs with that. And then, of course, there's sort of like empire building. And then when you get into the fraud, then clearly people are improperly or illegally taking money out of there or spending stuff on things like houses and cars that they're not supposed to. If you're running it properly, then the benefit would be for the people running it is well, first off, you're trying to do something that's hopefully making the world a better place. But then, you know, you can also get paid. People do get paid, and you can get paid, you know, easily six-figure salaries for helping to run an NGO. So there is some money to be made in that regard, if you are doing it properly. And so, yeah, there is some money to be made.
So why would the government, I mean, we have a whole infrastructure, do we not, of social services and programs. Why would they outsource this? What does the government stand to gain from this? Does it save it money or no?
Well, one thing is to try to save some money. And certainly, you know, there was a study examining how NGOs operate in New York City. And certainly one of the things that in New York City, why the city contracts with a lot of NGOs for social services is that there's a lot more flexibility. In New York, you know, you've got very strong public sector unions. And so if the city's going to do it themselves, they are bound by these union contracts with strict regulations and fairly high paid workers that they have to go through. And then also it's often very hard to let government workers, city workers or state workers go. They have strong protections through their unions. And so there's not a lot of flexibility. And then it also seems to be the case that a lot of the average folks working for an NGO, when they contract it in this fashion, the typical person getting paid or working for the NGO makes less money than the city employee would be, because the city employees, their salaries are all set through collective bargaining, and they've been set at a high level for a number of years. So it is a way to save some money on sort of like the rank and file people delivering the services. And then the flip side of it is actually that the people top salaries within a government, actual government bureaucracy, are often limited, and sometimes the top work people in an NGO can get paid more money than the top folks, the top paid civil servants in the government bureaucracy.
So it's like a transfer of wealth of what you're describing. I mean, you want the people who live in the city, live on the ground, to be part of the economy. They're kind of getting cut out from what you described.
Well, and certainly they're you know, NGOs do provide a lot of employment, and certainly historically, you know, a lot of charities have been more effective with government with trying to help people than government social services have been. So I think another part of this question, another part of this whole equation is, we've always had very effective charities in this country that can deliver social services very well. They do a good job helping people, and oftentimes without a lot of money. And so you see these very effective private charities, and then you look at like governments that maybe aren't, you know, the government's spending a lot of money on the bureaucracy and doesn't seem to be delivering a lot. So I think there is a part of this to approach and say, well, maybe, you know, if the government was to, instead of trying to provide welfare assistance of different types directly, if they could work with some of these effective charities and get the money in that way, then that might be a more effective way to provide social services.
Does it actually happen, though? Sounds good in theory, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds good in theory. And I, you know, I am a big supporter of certainly traditional charities. I think, you know, historically, dollar for dollar, my research has been in the area of natural disasters. I mean, I think it's very clear that dollar for dollar, like the love that the charities working in this space deliver a lot more than FEMA does or state emergency management agencies. So I think, you know, you do have some really effective charities, and trying to build a safety net through private charity is, in one sense, a desirable and admirable thing. But again, it's less clear. It's worked so well, and then separately, you've got the whole issue of all of the fraud that's been going on.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get to that. I want to just tease apart the political side of this, though. when I look at NGOs, you know, I used to think it was just the UN driven, right? But there's a lot of political NGOs, and you know, whoever has the pocketbook has the power, so they're able to have a messaging, you know, some sort of social programming and engineering that seems to be going along with this. So it's not just help the system, it's about skew it to your point of view.
That's definitely true. And Michael Schellenberger, who's a reporter, he now works with a public news. He's written a lot on specifically the NGOs with regard to homelessness policy in California. Like in California, since Gavin Newsom's been governor, spent something like $24 billion to try to alleviate homelessness. And most of that money has gone through NGOs. And all they've done is like increase the homeless population by 30,000 over that period of time. So they haven't like solved the problem, and it seems to have gotten worse. And Mr. Schellenberger in his work details how it is that the NGOs operating in that space, they have a very specific ideas about how they think to solve homelessness, this idea of housing first, that all you have to do is build housing, then put people into housing, then their problems will be taken care of. But you know, Mr. Schellenberger points out most of the California's homeless are suffering either from addiction or they have mental illness. And so they can't stay in housing because of this instability for these other reasons that they're unstable. And so just trying to put them in a fancy apartment isn't addressing the underlying problems. But though the whole issue there is that the NGOs operating in this space have this strong opinion. They get funding both from wealthy donors and then through all of these contracts that they get. They get plenty of money, and they don't seem to have to change their ways. They keep getting the money for doing what they're doing, and it's not working. But as long as they keep getting the money, they don't have to change what they're doing.
It's like a circle, basically. And there's no accountability here. So California is an excellent example, because I did read about that. It's not working, but they keep throwing money at it. Who's responsible? Who's holding the bag for this? Because somebody should say, we're spending bad money, we're not helping people, we're not fixing the underlying problem, as you so clearly stated. So where's the mindset or the break on, you're not getting another dime until you fix it, or we have to have a meeting, a coming together to figure out that this isn't working, so we need to shift. Where does that happen?
That's a good question, because, I mean, it doesn't. And that seems to be the problem. And certainly, you know, one of the issues is that the leaders of the NGOs, along with some of the wealthy donors, and then the same folks who are probably running the state agencies in California, giving them the contracts, they're sort of all on the same page. And so they all think that what they're doing is going to work. And I presume that my guess would be is if it doesn't work, then they just say, well, we need to spend even more money. And there is no feedback. There's no nothing to come in to say, you know, this isn't working. We have to try something else. And certainly the politicians like Gavin Newsom really find it difficult or impossible to break out of this, to say no to these folks, because they're all very progressive. And you know, Governor Newsom is a liberal, certainly in line with the progressive feelings, and so it's very difficult to say no to sort of the voices of morality or the voices saying this is what we need to do if we want to be a good society. We have to address homelessness in this fashion, and it's very difficult for any politician that's already sort of in those circles and wanting to get approval from those groups to say no to them, to just draw a line or say this isn't working, we're going to try something new, because they that this group of NGOs and probably top government officials and then donors are really carrying a lot of the moral authority here, and they would say they would be upset and irate if you tried to go some other direction. They would accuse you of you know, wanting to harm the homeless as opposed to help them.
That's really sad. It's always that, you know, fake outrage when you're actually not doing anything. On that note, let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter. And before the break, I think you were doing a really wonderful job of laying out the groundwork for the theory behind an NGO. And what struck me, and I make sure I really understand this. I understand there are mega donors, there's billionaires who give the money, but what's the taxpayers' portion of this? Is it a 50-50? How do the taxpayers get fleeced in this situation in terms of, and you know, involuntarily, I would think, putting money into this pot?
Well, it comes as when the government is going to, whether it be the city government or the state government, the federal government, or you know, as you mentioned, the United Nations does a lot with that, international NGOs as well. When one of those levels of government have taxpayer dollars and they decide that they're going to partner with some NGO to do this, then they will do a contract with the NGOs. We saw some of that with in the Environmental Protection Agency late in the Biden administration. They were trying to funnel $20 billion, and that's billion with a B, $1 billion through different NGOs to provide different services. One of which was the lady Stacey Abrams in Georgia. She had started a NGO and they had almost no money and no history or anything, and they got a $2 billion contract with the EPA to weatherize homes and otherwise upgrade the insulation in homes. And this was a brand new NGO, and it clearly started just for the purpose of trying to get this money. So when the government makes a decision that they're going to route this money for these different services through NGOs that are then going to go ahead and do things, you know, that's how the taxpayers come into the equation. So, you know, Gavin Newsom and the state of California decided, you know, they allocated $24 billion to, you know, address homelessness in this big initiative since he's been governor. And so, I mean, that's the, you know, the tax dollars there in the California, and the, you know, the state's now very much in the got a big budget deficit. But you know, they raised that money, and then the state legislators decided to appropriate it in this fashion. And then, you know, then there is also the selection of the NGOs. But again, that's sort of like a closed circle in that it's the same circle of folks going from the government into the NGOs, and also, you know, from the foundations that are helping to fund all this. It's many times the same folks cycling from one to the other, like a revolving door that you hear so much criticism about it with regard to defense contracting. It's really sort of the same situation.
Wow. Is there any citizen group, like let's say somebody who's really an advocate for the homeless, are they actually involved in any of these decisions, or it's just coming from down on high and they just have to accept it?
And I can only speak to some of the examples that I've read about. So many times that there are, you know, and it's the top bureaucrats that are probably making the decisions. It's not going to be Gavin Newsom in California isn't going to decide this. You've got some high level bureaucrats who would be making decisions about what NGO to put to try and do a contract with. At least certainly in the federal government, you usually have to put out a request for proposals. And so I'm sure that the state level there is something similar. But again, although you might put out a request for proposals and for contracts of this nature, many times it seems like they already know who they want to give the money to.
Yeah, I would think so. And, you know, Minnesota's situation really highlights a lot of this circular spending. You know, it was my impression that, yeah, the NGO gets the money, but then there's a side of it where it goes back into the government to support campaigns. And, you know, there was straight money coming to some of the people, the leaders in the Minnesota infrastructure and the government. Is that unusual? Or is that something that you think happens as well? I mean, it's like you're greasing a palm, basically, but is that something that you think is also an issue?
It certainly is. And I think, you know, and it's probably not just NGOs. If you've got other businesses that are getting, that are contracting with the government, you're probably giving some campaign contributions. I live in Alabama, and we have these Alabama Beverage Commission liquor stores. And the story is clear. If you're a building owner and you'd like to have one of those state-run stores operate in the building, rent from you in the building you own, you had better be making a campaign contribution to the right folks, or you're not going to get the deal. You're not going to get the business. So I think there's clearly a big part of that. And that's sort of like normal operations. I mean, at some level, I'm sure defense contractors give a lot of money to politicians, campaign contributions. So some of it's pretty standard business. It's not clear how much, particularly in Minnesota, might have been coming back. Because, you know, clearly in those cases, those fraudulent NGOs, the ones that, you know, were running daycare centers and not without any children, mm-hmm. were clearly, some of that money had to be going back to some of the folks in the state, some of the Democratic Party officials. We don't have the documentation yet, but I mean, it would surely seem that some of that money had to go back in campaign contributions or maybe other forms of payment.
Understood. Now, you mentioned California with the homeless situation, but there are other huge programs. You've written in the article that there's a Medicaid housing stabilization services, child nutrition program, services for autistic children. These are huge, you know, social needs. You know, we in Georgia, I think there are plenty of people, probably innumerable, who can't access services because there's not enough money for them, especially, let's say, an adult with autism, for example. I mean, are they actually, I mean, I know the Somali issue with the daycare is one thing, but did that also expand to the autistic services? I think there was senior living facilities, right? There's so many things that people actually literally depend life and death on. Did those also get affected by this?
Well, some of that now, I mean, you think of like a senior living assistance. I mean, you know, surely with Medicare and really actually Medicaid pays for many Americans to stay in an assisted living facility. So, you know, that there's always been that part of it. And so that's not government dollars. It's not really quite the same mechanism in that Medicare and Medicaid will pay for assisted living care for people who need it and don't have the money, you know, to afford it. Uh-huh. And those have typically been private companies that are running the nursing homes. And so they, you know, they get customers and then the government is paying the bill. But yeah, you're right. There's all kinds of different services, and autistic children is an important part of that, because I know over the last 10 years or so, many states have greatly expanded the amount of a public assistance going to help young children with autism. And again, the legislators, lawmakers in different states, we did this in Alabama a few years ago, you know, decide that this is an important and valuable cause. And so we're going to do something to try to help this. And then if the money, you know, goes to folks who aren't doing a very good job helping, then that's a problem. Obviously, it's a big problem, because and especially in the cases of Minnesota, we're seeing like nobody's getting assistance. So the money is going places. No children, no autistic children are being helped, it would seem. And that money could have gone to help pay for services from children who really needed them.
Now, you mentioned, I would think back in the day before all of this infrastructure got set up, it was really very straightforward, right? Mostly churches, religious institutions, pooling their money and helping their own community. Was that how this really started? A Samaritan's Purse reminds me of how it used to be, right? It's just, you donate to the church does the work, you're involved as the parishioner, and there's no middleman.
Yeah, there's actually some great historical research that went back in some of the great disasters, terrible disasters in American history, and what happened there. And there was like a tremendous private sector assistance after like the Chicago fire in 1871. The city of Chicago actually appropriated some money that went to the private assistance. And there were actually some other states, I think, that decided they sent some money to Chicago to help them rebuild after the fire. It was all private in that there's a private local community with a bunch of community leaders that were running it and handing out the assistance to businesses and families that needed help to rebuild, and also just for a shelter after so much of the city had burned. So there was some government assistance there. And then, over the years, once you had the income tax and you started to give tax deductions for charities, that was a kind of indirect, but that's certainly a way to try to encourage people to make donations, to give money to charities. And so the government has been involved with that part of the IRS has to verify whether something's a legitimate charity in doing something with that. And for a long time, there's been, there have always been some charities that are spending 90% of the money they get on fundraising. And so, they've largely been sort of a scam. But there have been some good mechanisms that arose in that space to help identify which charities are really just sort of like fronts as opposed to legitimate charity. So, this has been something we've been trying as a nation for a long time. And, I'm a big fan of voluntary solutions. And so many of us as a free market economists have long had this great interest in, we should rely more on private charity. It's more effective. There are lots of great, good examples of how they've helped a lot of problems.
Got you. On that note, let's take our second break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. Before the break, you were really giving us a really good historical framework for how it was very straightforward, and now you have almost a corporatized version of the same thing. You mentioned the IRS can do oversight. Does it do oversight in this situation? And if it did, how on earth could these scams continue for so long?
Well, I think that's a good question and a good point, because I think it highlights a weakness of a lot of our government assistance of this form. And that is that you have bureaucrats who are approving, the contracts, approving the spending of the money, and they're not really doing any kind of auditing or forensic analysis of the forms. They're simply looking what forms have to be filled out so that you can register and get some of this. For instance, during the COVID pandemic, if we want to make sure children are getting fed, because as the schools are closed, they're not getting school lunches through that. So you have the process, and somebody has to fill out the all the paperwork. They have to have all the forms. And so you've got somebody working for the government, and all they're basically doing is looking to see that all these forms are filled out properly, and you've got all of the attached documents. And if that's true, then they'll approve it. A similar way to think about it is, so you think of the IRS. When you file your taxes, they look to make sure that you filled out all the documents, you have all of your forms attached. And if so, then the IRS will go ahead and process your return and maybe pay you a refund if you're due a refund. And so, you know, you have at one level, you have people processing this, but they're sort of really assuming that, say, all of that documentation is legitimate, that it's not been actually completely and totally falsified. And it would be with taxes, it's then the folks at the IRS that conduct audits that go digging into, you know, Americans' tax returns to try to see if things were actually falsified, or try to see if somebody is spending a lot more money than they're claiming on their income taxes, or something of that nature. We see this all over the case. This came up with a few years ago with the department, U.S. Department of Education and assistance to colleges. You had some for-profit colleges that were just turning in like completely falsified material, but you know, sort of fell through this crack, because unless you then hire and pay for enough auditors to go in and audit this, and then the folks just processing the applications are largely, again, taking what they're being given with a presumption of validity. And that's sort of, I think, the hole that's getting exploited here. That's the weakness, that we simply don't appropriate enough money, and the government isn't appropriating enough money to do enough auditing of, you know, for instance, the NGOs that are allegedly providing services.
That's a very good point. And it makes a corollary question of all these state governments running in the red with all these pensions that they are coming due that they, I don't know if they can afford to pay or not. Was this some sort of, how can I put it? It made sense for them, if you're not paying government employees, that you're going to have to pay their pension down the road if you outsource it and privatize it. Does that get these local governments off the hook for all of these city employees that they're going to owe?
Well, you know, you're Dr. George, that's a great point, because that's, again, another part of the reason why some people like this idea of privatizing or doing contracts with NGOs as opposed to having the government do it themselves, because then those are public sector employees. And then you've got, not only have high pay, but you also have those pension benefits that are there and very substantial. So, you know, that's another part of the equation. They're trying to avoid some of these high-priced government workers by contracting with NGOs that are, well, don't offer the same pension benefits, don't offer the same salaries that some of the actual city or state employees would be getting, and especially in cities in like New York and California, where the public sector unions are so strong and the workers get paid very well with very good benefits. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of that looming issue of public pensions has been one of the factors leading to wanting to try to do more through the private sector or through these NGOs.
But when they find these fraud pods, and this, I mean, we're talking, I think we said $1 billion in fraud in Minnesota. Do you think they'll ever see that money? Can they get it back?
Much of it's probably not, because I know Somalis have apparently declared at least $700 million in cash that they've flown out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport, presumably back to Somalia. That money's never coming back. You know, clearly there are people who are working for some of these fraudulent groups, and yeah, we can probably have some ability to go after them. If they bought fancy houses and cars, those are things that, you know, when the process, in many of these prosecutions have already occurred, right? There have already been dozens of folks convicted for these different fraudulent cases. We can certainly try to get some money back from them. You know, we just simply don't know how much, if any, we're going to be able to get back. And then the bigger question of like how much is fraud or really boosting how much we're spending on government.
That's really disheartening, actually. And I don't see, even though there was a huge, you know, the media out outpouring of information. Has there been any change in the infrastructure? Has any government that's been nailed, let's say the Minnesota, for example, because that's the most salient, have they talked about changing this, getting rid of the NGOs, going back to real oversight and having employees that are, I wouldn't say real per se, but they're really the citizens of the state working, making a living, you know, just having a real economy, not this.
That's a good point. And you know, because and that is something that comes up a lot when you go through privatizing, then those individuals are not actually working for the government. And so there's lots of things in terms of disclosure or freedom of information. There things can be a lot less transparent because it's actually like a private company. I was just reading recently with regard to national security and national defense, because those are usually private companies as opposed to NGOs. But the same issues are there. You've got you've got people who are employees not of the government but of an NGO or a private business, and they are, you know, they don't have some of the same duties that you would have if you're truly in the public sector in terms of, you know, sunshine laws and all the disclosure. There already have been a number of different federal prosecutions here. And the one thing that was kind of problematic in Minnesota is that this ended up having to be federal prosecutors coming into this, because it didn't seem like at the state level anybody was interested in doing anything about this. But these are, you know, some of those, certainly the Medicaid and the child nutrition assistance, those are some federal programs. And so there is federal oversight, and the prosecutions occurred through the federal courts. You know, there certainly already has been some, and I'm sure that, you know, I know that the Trump administration has sent a number of, the Department of Justice is devoting a lot of resources to try to root out more of this fraud in Minnesota. But I haven't seen anybody really sort of question the NGO model.
Wow. You know, the sad part too, there are Congress people who've been caught up with this COVID cash and these fraud situations. They made claims and it didn't exist. So this is right through the system. It's not just the NGOs. It's like the infrastructure is just set up for graft. I mean, there's no accountability from what you just described. You know, do the paperwork, sign the paperwork, create your organization, to getting funded. I mean, it's like friends of, if you described what went on in Georgia, making up some NGO, if it's that easy to do, I wonder how she got caught. You know, it's like a gift basically that stopped. But yeah. I just don't understand how the government, you know, if you're a citizen doing these things, you don't have all this money, they're on you 24/7. As a physician, if you send a claim that's incorrect for Medicaid or Medicare, they're going to nail you. I mean, it's like you're doing work, right? You may make a stake on the claim and they will come after you, but they're completely agnostic for this. That just kind of, it's like a two-tier system.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, as you mentioned, with Medicaid and Medicare, I mean, there is a pretty good, there's a good amount more of the auditing that's going on, right? Because, I mean, that's how the feds are detecting that you've billed something incorrectly, although it's, to my impression, it seems like many times it's just like you billed with the wrong code. That doesn't seem to be like a big deal. But you're right. There's a lot of oversight there, and there's a lot of work that goes on there. I mean, we really need a lot more oversight on other things, and I'm just not sure. I mean, a part of it is the scale of things, right? You know, and just all of the different money, all of the different federal programs that are being assisted in this fashion. And then the other part of it is that politicians are going to get credit for doing things like providing service, saying we're going to have a program to assist autistic children, or we're going to have a child nutrition programs. You don't get a lot of points for appropriating money to have a bunch of people doing auditing of these contracts. And so we really need to try to change that, because if we can change that, if we, and also the part of it that everybody who's contracting, everybody who's a public sector employee, because I'm an employee of a state university, I mean, everybody who is getting money from the government should, you know, be absolutely willing to be completely scrutinized, because it's taxpayer dollars. And hopefully we're appropriating that money to do important and valuable things, because we're taking it from the taxpayers. So we should only take it to do valuable things. And then you should have a high standard of being willing to, you know, be scrutinized to make sure that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing with the money that you're receiving.
I mean, it doesn't sound like it would be hard. I mean, and, you know, that should be the baseline, right? Because if you're a steward of your taxpayers' money, that would be the first thing that you would have to do. It's really disheartening that it's just this big sinkhole. And really, people may be found accountable, but this is a bigger picture, isn't it? I mean, this is ingrained in how it's set up from what you described.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, when you start to think about some of these different things, like, you know, the state of California has that high-speed rail rate that they've spent far more money on than with the homelessness, and they haven't built very much in the way of railroads. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act had all those billions of dollars for electric vehicle charging stations, and not very many of them got built. And so you just sort of think that money probably didn't, you know, actually totally disappear, but it got spent on something. And I suspect that, you know, we want to start digging in there, you're going to see some problems. I know Gavin Newsom was opposing even auditing of the $24 billion they've spent on homelessness. They just don't even want to have to report what's happened to it.
I hope this is the beginning of the end of this, so that, you know, you shine light on this. And I don't think, I'm going to ask you this after the break. So let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. Dr. Sutter, how can people read what you write? And if you still have a podcast, correct?
I write for Yellowhammer News and 1819 News here. Those are two different sites. I have different columns on those. Those are news organizations here in Alabama. And I do have a show called E-Conversations. It runs on the Troy University's cable television channel, but the episodes go up on YouTube.
Great. You know, we talked about the problem. I want to start, if we can, try to figure out some solutions on this. But my question was, before the break, does anybody have any kind of, are they embarrassed? I don't see any embarrassment. I see doubling down and what else, who cares kind of thing. Is there any movement towards, we need to change this because now that the light is shined on it, it can't continue to do the same. We can't keep doing the same thing, expecting a different result.
I think a part of the issue, a part of the problem when it comes to oversight and accountability is just how much money gets spent. I mean, some of what was coming out with Elon Musk and the Doge efforts in Washington, there's just, you know, you have all of these millions of different spending items, and, you know, and it's so hard to try to keep track of or to track all of this stuff. You have so many different employees. You can't even figure out who's doing stuff. And then you've got, you know, at the federal government level, you've got a lot more contractors than you have actual employees. So you've got this huge data management problem. I think that's one area where I certainly hope, although, you know, Doge isn't getting any the publicity, it hasn't gone away. But I think that's the kind of place where if you had some smart technical folks who could go in there, and I'm sure that they could build some AI-based oversight structures to help us identify things a lot more effectively. I know some of what they said, they said something like one third of all of expenditures they were trying to review at the federal government didn't even have some code on it saying what it was for. And so, you know, and things just get approved to be paid with like without any kind of scrutiny. And so that can't happen. I think, you know, one of the things we perhaps as citizens, taxpayers could push on is to say that, you know, you've got to appropriate adequate amounts of money for oversight, for auditing, for doing this. But I think there is also the really good opportunity with some new technology to get a handle on things that we couldn't possibly have before. And so Doge was doing some things to try to link together different databases and then be able to better scrutinize things. So, and then also use AI to be able to process all of this stuff because it's just such a massive problem and at least a way to start. So, I mean, I think there were some exciting things from Doge and what they were trying to do with AI and some of the technology that could really help create some new opportunities for oversight and maybe help catch some of the stuff.
On the flip side, I mean, I'm all about law and order from the standpoint of people not gaming the system. But can it go a bridge too far? Can it be used in a way that you don't have privacy? You start linking things together, making connections that it may not be, and then the person who's being investigated or on the radar, how do they protect themselves? So can it go too far? It's like the cart's already out and you're trying to pull it back, but everybody's going to get painted with the same brush. And the people who are doing it and people who are benefiting from it, to me, don't seem to be facing the real consequences.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, and certainly that was one of the objections being raised. I know in some of the litigation that try to block Doge from getting access to all some of the databases that they want, some of the records that they wanted to be able to get, were privacy concerns, and those are there, and they should be very real. But there's also the part of it is that if you are, as we were talking about before, if you're a public sector employee, if you're running a business that's or a nonprofit that's contracting with the government, I mean, I think you should be subject to a high level of scrutiny, and there should be no, you know, you don't have to do that. And so if you choose to get work for the government or contract for the government, then you are choosing to subject yourself to scrutiny, and you know, taxpayers should demand and should be able to completely demand a full accountability of how their money is being spent.
I think you're right. But can we start from the beginning, like vetting people who put in the contracts from the get-go, like doing a real deep dive on whoever is creating the NGO or stepping in to take the contract? Doesn't seem like there's a lot of vetting, and perhaps there's some conflict of interest as well going on. You know, if somebody is your constituent, trying to get an NGO and using their help from their congressperson to do it, should that even be allowed? It's just too close to me.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, and you know, as we clear, the federal government runs programs that have a good amount of oversight and don't award money to just anybody. Like over the years, I've sent funding proposals to the National Science Foundation. They do a good job of reviewing those, but you know, then you also see the things like Stacey Abrams' brand new NGO with like $100 in the bank, and then they get a $2 billion contract from the EPA. Clearly, that can't be the standard fashion. The standard way of doing things. So that's already pretty suspect. But I mean, if you were somebody with a lot, with very good connections, then, you know, then it always seems to be possible for somebody who's high enough to call and say, we're going to approve that and you're not going to ask any questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to try to stop that. And at some level, you know, a better scrutiny, better surveillance and oversight could help help us detect when that's happening and allow us to be as citizens and taxpayers to complain about or discipline folks for saying, like, you know, whoever was there at the EPA who decided to give this $2 billion to this new startup NGO that had never done anything, that just can't be allowed.
I agree. And, you know, this whole, let's go back to the real example here with Minnesota. Part of the method of shutting down conversation was the, it's racist, sexist, you know, that argument that people use. Just, it's, I don't know what to say about it, but it seems to want to shut down the conversation by using that as an excuse. How can we make it so that it is colorblind, that it's standardized? Doesn't matter what color you are. Doesn't matter where you came from. Either you're a crook or you're not. And everybody has to, you know, be held to account.
I would totally agree with that. And I think it should, because, I mean, you know, it should be the public trust. If you are getting assistance from the government, if you're getting these contracts, if you're spending taxpayer funds, then you should be fully accountable. And that shouldn't be, that's nothing sexist or racist or anything about that. That's just basic decency and respect for the taxpayers who are being made to pay taxes to support this. And they, because, you know, we're supposed to have a government of the people and by the people and for the people, the taxpayers are ultimately the ones in charge. And they're you know, and everybody should view that as their ultimate boss. I've always worked for state universities, and I do always think we should be thinking about, why are we spending taxpayer dollars in this fashion? Is this something we really need to do? Is this, how would you explain to some taxpayer what it is that we're doing? Is this fully on the up and up? And you know, we just, you know, certainly I think in Minnesota, you know, once the Somali business NGOs started to raise those claim that this is just racist, you had nobody in the political sector there really wanted to be called a racist. So it seemed like that became a very effective way to shut down any scrutiny.
Unfortunately. But maybe another way to rein it in is have a moratorium, right? You have maybe 3 years of your NGO. And then if you're not producing what you say you're going to, you just get shut down. So it has a sundowning to it. Does that even exist?
I mean, I would think, you know, I can just say, you know, from the standpoint of pursuing grants from the National Science Foundation, nobody I knew of ever got like $1 million or a $10 million grant their first time writing a proposal to the NSF. Right? You had to build up and get a track record of having gotten small grants and done the stuff and delivered before you got anything big in that regard. So, I mean, you know, there are ways in which this can be done the right way. I don't know, presumably some of these big ones are intentionally being done to not be done the right way.
Understood. So, you know, in the minute or so that we have left, I want to make sure people know again how to read what you write, because you have your finger on the pulse of our economy. And I think people learn a lot from reading what you write. So how can they do that?
I write at Yellowhammer News here. And so if you just say Daniel Sutter, Yellowhammer or News, Google that, you'll get to my page where they post all my columns. I write for Yellowhammer News almost every week. I try to do it every week. And then I also write some paper, some columns for 1819 News, another organization here in Alabama. Those I write are a little more focused on current policy issues here in the state of Alabama.
Dr. Soter, I want to thank you so much for joining me. It was a really, I think, a highlight of our conversation, so people can start doing their own due diligence and look at what their money's doing and not just be so passive, because it is our money. And we want to make sure that our fellow citizens are helped, not somebody just taking money and doing God knows what with it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like this money's supposed to be helping people who really need help, and it's not going there. And that's the real tragedy. That's a real shame.
Well, thank you again. I can't wait to have you back on.
Always happy to join you, and glad to have had the chance to chat here.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.